This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. Fantastic to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast, talking parenting, family life, education on today's show. And family comes in all forms. Solo, single parents are often somewhat neglected when it comes to conversations about parenting here in Dubai. So we spoke to some of the families we know, bringing together mums from all different backgrounds and different circumstances, talking about the struggle, the juggle, the challenges, and indeed the opportunities. And some great advice as well from clinical psychologist Jessica Rose Lee. We were also talking about caring for the elderly, again, a group of people that we really don't hear much about here in the UAE. What are your options when it comes to getting older, retiring here as an expat or indeed an Emirati? One study shows that come 2050, there's going to be more and more of us getting old here. But what is in place from the practical to the emotional? And WhatsApp groups and Facebook groups exploded recently when Real Housewives of Dubai was announced. It is coming next year. The cast has not been confirmed, but it is on. We were speaking to Selena Waterman-Smith, who was on BBC One's Apprentice show, about what happens after the cameras stop rolling and what she wished she knew before she became a reality TV star. We
are family. Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
And families take all different forms, shapes and sizes. It's Singles Day on November 11th, and many people equate this with online shopping and sales. But today on our parenting show, we've chosen to take a different direction, looking at a subject that's not often talked about here in the UAE. Solo parenting. There are many solo single parents in Dubai. Not many people realise that. Now joined now by single mum Alison Rago. She's been solo parenting since 2015. Her daughter Kristen is now 8. She works full time and of course is really hands on with Kristen as well. Alison, how are you?
Hi, I'm all right. Nice to talk to you here again.
It's lovely to see you. I normally just see you on Instagram, so to be able to chat with you is a treat, so thank you. And thank you for your honesty today. I think it's really important that we hear from people that are doing it and doing it well and being open about the struggles too. You're divorced, caring, of course, and providing for Kristen on your own. Why do you think this is something that we don't often discuss openly here in the UAE?
I think it's cultural. So, you know, I think the East and the West have always been different. It's not in the UAE, India. It's emerging now, but it's still not something that is completely 100% accepted. So I really think it's cultural, which is what I narrow it down to, where I think, you know, different sides of the globe have just different things. Perhaps that's why it's not as openly talked about over here.
Mm-hmm. And now you, as I said, working full time. What's it been like on the practical front, Alison, in terms of balancing time and finances as a working single parent?
So it's chaotic, obviously. I've had help. So my family has helped me along the way greatly. But I've also had her paternal grandparents here where we've maintained the relationship where they've helped me with looking after her in the earlier years. Now, of course, she's 8 and a half. And I've actually also been quite fortunate to always have worked from home. And this greatly helped. But I literally don't have too much time for myself. So you're just doing I do kid, home, work, and then myself. But I think it's a bit of a switch in your mind where I told myself when I flew 3,000 miles away from a failing marriage. So for me, I knew what I was doing and I knew that no matter what, I had to make it work. And 8 years, well, it's 6 years from then and we're okay. I mean, I've been through quite a year this year myself, but I just turned 40 and I think I've come out strong. I've come through this year. So all's well that ends well. I don't think there's any one formula to do it. You just have to wake up each day and, I think I do it more for my child. You have to remind yourself why you're doing what you're doing. And truly the path has unfolded for me. Not always smoothly, but here I am still standing and smiling. And I think this is the greatest thing of it all, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's not easy. I'm not going to say it's easy. I'm not going to say everyone can do it perhaps as easily as I'm saying it. But it will get better. And a lot of people do move on, they remarry. I haven't gotten there yet, only because I don't know where to start. You know, like I've come 40, and sometimes it's challenging to push that reset button. But I believe it will happen in its own course.
I wanted to ask you if you've got any advice for anyone out there who's maybe separating or divorcing or is in the early days of single parenthood. Is there anything that you wish you'd known, Alison, before all of this unfolded that perhaps would have made life easier or have set you up with more knowledge, really?
Yeah, I think don't drag, like, so perhaps I dragged my whole failing marriage for so long, you know, which I would say to someone that, when people around me, my own family said, leave. I would say, if you know, I mean, if it's intuitive, if you know that it's not going anywhere, just exit. Now, again, I'm saying this because I've been through it, but in spite of everyone around me saying this to me in 2015, I didn't do it. So it is really easier said than done. And I really think whether you, I know a lot of women that for whatever reason chose to leave, did it so instantly. And I know people like me that it took so long, you know, to make that decision to actually walk away. So, like I said, it's easy to say, but you really only know from your own story. But the truth is, when you do feel like it's the time to leave, do it. Just do it. You know, there's no regret. Like, don't live behind. I know a lot of people that actually feel really bad that it happened to them. I think you never live behind the wall of guilt or shame. Everyone's life is different. We all, no one's life is perfect. And if you truly understand that, then whatever our path is, and I really believe everything that happens is the biggest teacher. So I take it as a teacher.
Everything happens for a reason. Everything happens for a reason. Alison, thank you so much for being with us today and speaking so honestly. It really is incredibly valuable, I'm sure, for a lot of people listening today.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Discussing single parenthood here in the UAE, and amongst many of the challenges is starting things on your own without the support of a partner. I'm joined live on the phone now by Caroline Hassett, a single mum since 2012. She's got an 11-year-old daughter. Caroline, how are you?
Good, thank you, Helen. How are you?
I'm really well, and thank you for talking today. I feel like this is a conversation that tends to exist in small Facebook groups of men and women who are going through similar, but not something we hear about on the radio or indeed talk in general about. So I think it's really important to be hearing about people's different experiences. Can you tell us a little bit about the professional side, what you went through when you were looking for a job as a single parent a few years ago?
Well, when I was looking for a job, the moment they realized I was a single mom, the conversations were more towards, well, are you willing on weekends? How dedicated will you really be? We're not sure this is the job for you. We're not sure you can handle this. And, you know, it stopped being about my skills.
They had a lot of doubts about, not so about capability, but as you say, kind of that dedication, flexibility, the logistics side.
And it was more about that.
So why do you think that companies tend to prefer not to hire single parents? We're talking about mums in your case, obviously. Did they ever explicitly say that?
Well, they were afraid that I would, you know, if we had something going on at the school, that I would be the only one who had to go. I couldn't send somebody else. Or if she was sick, then I had to stay home. There wasn't anyone else at home to stay home with her. Or if I was out with her on the weekend, then I wouldn't be dedicated or be able to come to work because I wouldn't have a babysitter. Mm-hmm. And I told them, well, I was working and I've been a single mom for 3 years by the time I was going around for interviews. So I was able to, but they weren't convinced and they didn't want that. They preferred somebody single, and if they were married, than somebody with a partner.
So this must have been frustrating, baffling, annoying. And instead of kind of railing against these people who, you know, we've talked before about flexibility, it's not just about parenthood, it's about, you know, we're just talking about looking after older people. You know, we all need more flexibility. But it's only some companies that are willing to realise that. You decided to go your own way. What did you decide to do?
Well, I took the last of my savings and I opened a company, and then I hoped that it would bring me money. But it was chicken and egg even then. They wanted a company with experience, and I couldn't get experience if nobody hired my company's services. So I worked the first 6 months I worked pretty much for free just to get companies and to build a portfolio. And after about 6 to 8 months, companies started responding to my company. And then they said, okay, we have this job. It started being small jobs. And then eventually it grew to what it is now.
I can only imagine how difficult that must have been, you know, juggling to start something from scratch where you are doing literally everything, every aspect of being a business owner from day zero and looking after your daughter. Were there any times you just thought, I'm just not sure I can do this?
A lot of times. For the first 6 months, I thought, what have I done? Did I make the right decision? But at the same time, I thought to myself, one of the reasons that I had done this is because if I had taken a job, and considering they were so focused on my dedication and working overtime and working weekends, would I really be doing justice to my daughter by working all the time, earning for her and not spending time or money with her?
And what an inspiration you are to her now. I mean, we hear all the time, and it's such a cliche, people say, you know, who are your heroes? And so many people go, oh, it's my mum. And I think, honestly, it's through stories like this that people go, wow, that is incredible to be working for 6 months, to be able to do things on your own terms for your own family. So thank you for sharing your story today. I hope it's given some hope to other women and indeed men listening today who have been feeling trapped by outdated company policies. And it sounds like things are going really well. Any advice to anyone listening who might have been going through something similar?
Just believe in yourself. Don't listen to the naysayers. Do what your heart tells you, and eventually everything does work out. It takes its own sweet time, and sometimes you really test, you know, it tests you, but it works out.
Caroline, thank you so much for being with us. Really, really appreciate it.
We are family. Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Discussing families of all shapes and sizes and talking to single mums this hour, Lindsay got in touch. She's a teacher with three girls.
I don't regret it for anything, but it's had its challenges, definitely. When you're looking at a financial aspect, you know, being a sole income earner with three girls, you know, in school, it's really tricky. It's really challenging. You just basically, you know, trying to stay afloat, you know, from day to day. The other aspect is loneliness. It can be very lonely for a single parent. I know, you know, there are so many social media communities out there for single parents. And yes, you reach out from time to time. But, you know, at the end of the day, you come home and you have to sort, you know, everything out. You have to be mom, dad, and everything in between. And it's lonely and it's tiring. The school systems, it's not really spoken about, you know. There's no, like, groups or discussions that are made or, you know, held for single parents or how they can be supported in the school and such. I wish there were. I also wish there were some type of concessions given for single parents. It would just make things a little bit easier, you know, especially with picking up kids and dropping kids off at home, at school and running in between, you know, it can be very challenging.
Lindsay, they're talking about her experiences. And if you want to share yours, please do get in touch. It's really challenging to be a parent when you're a two income household, but it's obviously significantly more logistical, financial and emotional issues for single parents too. We've got Jessica Rossley joining us, clinical psychologist at Thrive Wellbeing Centre, to offer her insights from an expert point of view. And, you know, the women we've spoken to this hour, Jessica, have been really open and honest about the tough times as well as the good times. Being a single parent sounds absolutely exhausting. There must be such a significant toll on the mental health. What are you hearing from patients and clients at Thrive?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me as a guest speaker.
You're welcome.
It's truly such a privilege to be able to talk about such an important topic. I think raising awareness and destigmatizing the single parent segment of society is really vitally important. As a society, and what I see in my parent sessions, we need to really validate the hardships and adversities that single parents face. But likewise, we need to offer hope and empower them and ultimately assist them to reclaim, rebuild, and thrive. And in doing so, really taking care of their mental health. I think whether by death, divorce, or choice, we need to remember that with single parenting, there's absolutely no discrimination. Mm-hmm. It can be mothers as well as fathers. And, you know, often I find that balancing life and it's something that definitely comes up in most of my sessions, but also managing guilt, blame and shame and not having resources and support. that's definitely aspects that, you know, is recurring themes mm-hmm. In sessions with parents. And I think it's so important that we as a society, you know, look at becoming a compassionate witness, an integrity partner for these single parents, that we can really, in a way, you know, look at how we can empower them, what can we put in place, small steps often, towards, you know, mental health improvement for them.
We spoke to Alison early, who's got an 8-year-old daughter, and she talked about how busy life is. You know, she's got work, mm-hmm. she's got her child, she has home to run, and then she seems to come at the end of the priority list, and that, you know, logistically there's only so many hours in the day, and you know, she did allude to guilt as well of, you know, staying in the marriage for longer than she'd planned to as well. Support groups must be hugely helpful, whether that is online or in person, because you presumably want to speak to people who are having similar experiences to you.
Absolutely. You know, you really need to utilize your resources, local community resources, looking at single parent support groups, finding a therapist that can be that compassionate witness for you, and just that integrity partner that can really support you through the process and help you to navigate your schedule. Mm-hmm. You know, we often refer to predisposing factors that makes us, you know, at risk and can really contribute to the development of mental health risk. So predisposing meaning those vulnerability factors that are present before the development of mental health problems. And as mental health professionals, we consider things like household composition, the support structure, your work status, managing your self-care to be some of the relevant predisposing features that can increase our vulnerability for mental health risks. And certainly research has shown us that single parenting is definitely considered as a predisposing factor, meaning placing this population group at a risk for possibly developing mental health risk. I just want to point out the Holmes and Rocky stress scale, for example, rated death of a spouse as the first highest stressful life experience, divorce as the second highest, and marital separation as the third highest. So in other words, single parents have many compounding factors. This isn't just about raising children and ensuring their mental health in a single household, but also navigating your own emotional experiences.
Absolutely.
So often these parents feel a deep sense of hopelessness, doubt, you know, overall confusion, overwhelm. Like you said, there's only so many hours in the day. But we as mental health professionals, we don't want this vulnerability to take up permanent residency in their emotional makeup. And I really want to instill hope and inspire single parents listening today that single parenting should not define you. Neither should it define your child. Because what I often see in my practice is that parents are so concerned that they will get stigmatized and their children will get stigmatized and have poor outcomes. However, it's better for a child to grow up in two separate healthy environments as opposed to be subjected to chronic marital discord mm-hmm. or volatility. So being a single parent and being a child from a single household should absolutely not make you anything less deserving.
Can I ask you, Jessica, a little bit about, because when you look at other parts of the world, and obviously I'm from the UK, huge number of single parents there, huge, some, as you know, some by choice, some by divorce, some by being widowed, of course. But in the UAE, I feel like it is very much a minority. And unfortunately, that has, as we've alluded to, led to some stigma here. But do you have any advice for parents who might be going through separation or single parents out there who are trying to talk to their parents about their situation? Because it seems like Dubai society doesn't really want to talk about this, which can lead to people feeling shy or embarrassed about their situation.
Yes, of course. I think actually globally, there should be, you know, we need to raise more awareness and offer more support. And the golden rule is really to start with yourself. Of course you want that validation and support from your family, but often there's even a cultural stigma that we can't move around to. So what I always tell my clients is find your tribe. The saying of we need a village to raise children is not meant lightly, but we also need a village to support you. And you might not be able to get that from your parents. You might not be able to get that from your work colleagues. But you can find that by support groups, going to a therapist. Specifically at Thrive, we support single parents. We know how challenging this can be to manage on your own, and we provide a sense of containment and support as well as evidence-based strategies to manage your journey. So what I'm trying to say is there is a lot of compounding factors. It's your own grief process. It's possibly family members that don't understand. It's possibly the work. I mean, I just listened to one of the I think it was Caroline that mentioned how she struggled to actually navigate and getting into a company as a single mom. And that's absolutely, such a shame. But we really need to take ownership and see where we can find support and with who. You need to know
and positivity as well, because it can really much be a fresh start for so many people. Jessica, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. Really, really valuable to get your take on this as a mental health professional. Jessica Rossley speaking to us from Thrive Wellbeing Centre and joined on the line now by Lama. Lama, thank you for joining the conversation this afternoon. I think it's been wonderful to hear so many different perspectives from, Caroline seeing a really difficult situation as an opportunity to start her own business, hear how people are juggling. Can you tell us a little bit about you and your family?
Sure thing. Thanks for having me on the call, guys.
Pleasure.
Well, my journey has been, I think everybody that enters to marriage never expects, for that breakup. Mm-hmm. But I really believe that, maybe that first year it is very difficult, but later on, if you feel that you really see the essence of your child and you want the best for them, right? And I think all of us want that for our children. Mm-hmm. And so maybe putting our emotional state a bit on the side and focusing on their happiness, that has always been my journey. And I've been very lucky. I've been very blessed that I've become really good friends, more so after my marriage with my ex-husband and his new wife.
Wow.
And it's just a beautiful, beautiful relationship where the way she puts her, I mean, I'd love to kind of give her a shout out, Sarah Amigi, she's just been such a wonderful woman. She's loved my son as if it was her own. And this kind of relationship where we were accepting one another and all of us just looking at Adam and wanting the best for him, mm-hmm. it has been so refreshing. And I think always I'm so grateful that he's not just being loved by one parent and another, a mom and a dad, but it's like two moms and one dad. And it's such a gift, really.
Lama,
so
I love that kind of perspective. I think honestly that is, I've just got goosebumps. Such a wonderful perspective to offer up because, as Jessica alluded to there, we want the best for our children. And sometimes that means taking them out of one unhappy home and perhaps working between two happier homes. And I will quote Glennon Doyle's Untamed book, Till the Cows Come Home. But she talks a lot about ending her marriage because she wanted to set a good example to her kids. She didn't want to settle. So why would she give that example to her children? And I think that is actually a really mature way of looking at it. A lot of couples stay together for the sake of the children, and often that's not the best thing. And how wonderful that your relationship with your husband has obviously changed but has become more positive, a fresh start for your relationship, and to be able to add someone else to the pot when it comes to the love and support for your son. Thank you for sharing that perspective. I really hope that offers up some inspiration to anyone else out there who's navigating uncharted waters. And all the best to you and yours, Lama. Thank you so much.
Family Matters
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking solo parenting this hour and joined live on the line by Wendy Best. She's a single mum of two. She's a widow. She has been there, done that, and says she's on the other side of it now and is here to share her insights and some of the big learnings. Wendy, thank you. How are you today?
I'm great, Helen. How are you?
I'm really well, really, really well. And honestly, feeling...
Thank you for having me.
No, I think it's really important, to be honest, to be hearing from families of all different shapes and sizes and experiences. And I can't thank you enough for your honesty and vulnerability this afternoon, and to be able to hear from people who have had challenging times. We just heard from Lama, who now has an amazing relationship with her ex-husband and his new partner. And I think it's really important to be hearing these stories. So thank you for being with us. I think the fear factor has been very real, and that's something that we've heard from on the text line from the women we've been speaking to this hour about the unknown. That, you know, this is not what I thought my family life was going to be. So thank you for offering up your insights. You know, what would your advice be to women and indeed men who are new to solo parenting?
Well, I think number one, I would say don't doubt your ability to manage. Mm. I think as women especially, we have a tendency to really underestimate ourselves. But we have so much more strength and resilience than what we give ourselves credit for. I think we're naturally adaptive species, and with a capacity to address our challenges, both personally and professionally. Mm-hmm. And I think we also have, you know, as women, an innate sense of community and the ability to build really strong support networks. So that's important.
Absolutely. That might be in real life, or, you know, as expats, they might be on the other side of the world, or be virtual. But finding not necessarily like-minded, but people who have been there and had a similar situation and might have some stories to share or vulnerabilities to share, so you don't feel so alone. We're so lucky now to be more connected perhaps than ever before, and social media gets a bad rap for a lot of reasons, but I think for finding that tribe that you need specific to your needs, and it can be anything, you know, whether it's a specific medical condition or single parenting, whatever it might be, finding your tribe is absolutely crucial. We heard earlier from Alison, who's talking about, you know, trying to be a mum and being a dad and the admin and the housework. And it sounds like there's an awful lot of logistics and organisation involved. Wendy, what advice would you say about keeping on top of the practical, I guess?
Well, I mean, as you've mentioned, and as Jessica was saying from Thrive earlier on, that creating the tribe is fundamental. It's super, super important. It can be, you know, the, as you said, other online single mums groups or mums groups, even our colleagues, employers, our family, even organizations, building those up and having that team or that army, basically, mm-hmm. that you can mobilize when you need them. But keeping your ducks in a row, I think, has been important for me, from your finances and your backup plans and making sure that you have things in place like insurance and wills and retirement plans, and prioritizing your own professional and personal goals is really important.
And I was so happy that we've had so many messages about people talking about it being sometimes incredibly positive, a fresh start, you know, beginning of a new chapter. And I'm really pleased we've had that balance over the course of the last hour, because it, you know, there can often be a bit of a victim mindset. And I wondered if you had any insights on that aspect.
Yeah, I mean, it's been such a journey for me, and it's actually been quite a positive one. You know, I think it's really important to have a positive mindset about solo parenting rather than feeling shamed and victimized and lonely and overworked and disadvantaged and all of that. You know, you need to see it as an opportunity for professional growth or personal growth. And it's also great because I think that it develops your relationship with your children, that can be, you know, it's less overlooked when you're by yourself with them. And then, you know, your relationship with your family and your friends can be better too, because you don't have that partner to share your life with. I think you find out what your own capacity is and discover what's really important. And I think professional motivation is more amplified as well, because you have that motivation. It's actually quite empowering if you make a conscious decision to see it in that way.
I think that's exactly right. And I think with time, I'm sure that's a big factor as well, being able to get to that mindset. And you're an incredible example of that, Wendy. Thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. Real food for thought there, truly. And all the best to you and yours. Thank you.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is Sunday and we're talking children's health. parenting, family life. And in honesty, and I definitely play a role in this, a lot of the conversations we have tend to be about the youth. It's an extremely exciting time to be a young person here in the UAE. But what about the older generation? Joining us now to explain a little bit more about what a new study has found is Dr. Natasha Ridge, Executive Director of the Sheikh Sud Bansakah Al Qasimi Foundation for Policy Research. And they've recently done a study that is actually incredibly enlightening about perceptions and practicalities of the elders here in the UAE. Natasha, thank you so much for being with us a little bit. Can you explain a little bit first, before we get onto the data and the findings, a little bit about what the Al Qasimi Foundation does in general and why you're having a specific look at this part of the population?
Certainly, I'd be very happy to. So the Al Qasimi Foundation was founded in 2009. We're a research foundation that seeks to support the social and economic development of Ras Al Khaimah and the UAE more broadly. We do some programmatic work, but a big part of our work is research around social issues, mostly education. But from time to time, and this is one of those times, we do veer into other sectors, mainly around public health or urban development. But in this case, it's around, I guess, health and wellness more broadly. But the topic of aging for us now. So this is something that we've become quite interested in.
It's really, I mean, I say this as someone who has got 40 around the corner. But, you know, we're all living a lot longer. You know, that this has got a huge impact on everything from the jobs we take and the work we do to, of course, relationships. But there's also the practical side, the financial side. And I know many of us are guilty of this, about just not really thinking about it on behalf of ourselves, but also having a bit of a head in the sand about our parents' generation, even the grandparents' generation. And, you know, the youth really dominates the UAE's everyday culture because we are a very young part of the world. But this does often mean the elders sometimes get left behind. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about the study, and then we can go on to perhaps some of the challenges that they face. What were some of the main findings?
People aren't very prepared for aging in the UAE. I mean, as you said, we're a very young population here, but there was a lot of lack of knowledge about where you would go for help. Most people said that they would actually have to search on Google to know where you could get help as an older person. Less than one third of people knew anyone who was living, an elderly person. And here, elderly, I'll just clarify, is over 60. So these definitions are certainly...
Oh, my mum's going to be devastated.
Many of us are. So, but the good news is you're a youth until 35 in the UAE. So,
I'm between being, I'm a youthful elderly person. I'm in the middle.
Yes, yes. So we have a short window of adulthood. So we really, and we found as well that people generally want to stay in their homes, that they would like to be cared for by, actually, interestingly, in the UAE, people preferred to be cared by private health, in this case probably home assistance. Mm-hmm. And we find that in Australia, which is where the study is based on, there's a lot more preference on also external help, but more on the government. Interestingly, also, people who knew an older person were more likely to seek help from a private provider versus those who did not, who wanted to have help from their family more. So the realities of aging and perceptions of aging were very much impacted by how many older people you know, people knew, which is understandable completely.
That's good. I mean, when we think about improving healthcare, improved, you know, access, information, the world feeling more connected, it's, you know, it's a lot better time to be elderly than it was certainly, you know, 50 or even 100 years ago, of course. But what are some of the challenges that are facing that age group that you found through that survey and even, you know, have heard about anecdotally through your work at the foundation?
Well, I think, yes, and the study was really motivated when we were doing some, we were asking, like, who can we support during Ramadan, actually, and somebody mentioned to us, oh, there's an old age hospital in Ras Al Khaimah, and they just cater to the elderly. And we said, oh, well, we'll go there. And when we saw that really that it was something that you would have seen in the West, I don't know, maybe decades ago now, but just old people in hospital beds. Mm-hmm. And it was very sad, and we were actually very surprised. That was what really motivated us to do that, and that remains actually a very big challenge across the UAE, is just this lack of resources for aging. And then if you need medical care, I think after we looked around the whole UAE, only around 13 geriatric specialists in the entire country.
Wow.
Yeah, so even, you know, if you had some medical condition, it's very hard to find somebody. We have only one in the whole Northern Emirates. This places a great pressure on the healthcare system. And I mean, we have general internists, but we need specialists just as much as we have pediatricians and gynecologists. We also need geriatricians, obviously. And then just on the social front too, you know, how do you connect and do things, and where do you go, and you know, are there outings? These are also things that are missing.
Dr. Natasha Ridgeworth, Executive Director of the Alkasmi Foundation, talking about how we can care for our elderly as the population grows.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking family this afternoon, and in particular, the older generations. Caring for the elderly with Dr. Natasha Ridges, Executive Director of the Alkasmi Foundation. Now, Sharjah, Dubai, Abu Dhabi have services for the elderly that are available for locals. But what about the expats?
For expatriates and for other Emiratis, maybe older Emiratis living in cities, or, you know, it's very hard. It's very hard to get services, and it's, I think, very hard to connect to people of your age group, you know, who you could do things with. And so, yes, at the moment, it's in a very nascent stage. Since we started this research, there's been some new initiatives in Dubai, and you know, the entities we've been talking to, there is this renewed vigour in the sector, I would say, but it's still something that's quite a long way off.
Can I ask about perceptions then? Because a lot of, you know, what we're talking about are things that need to be initiated and innovated by the, you know, the youth. And I count anyone under 60. I'm putting us all in that youthful category.
Okay, we're all,
so surely our perception of life as an older person plays a big role in what's started by this generation. So what do we know about how the under 60s feel about the over 60s here in the UAE?
Well, there's some interesting sort of, I think, gaps in some people thought that, you know, to be old was to sort of to lose your mind. Some people thought that it would be that you weren't able to get around anymore. So there was some interesting, you know, things around mobility and mental agility that young people thought sort of went after 60, maybe a bit later. But
the day after your 60th birthday, you're basically bedbound, and you just have to play bridge, you know, and you know, eat really sad vegetable soup alone.
Exactly.
You know, this is actually
There wasn't a very, I think there wasn't such a positive perception, especially if they really, you know, didn't know anybody who was, you know, above that age. And I think the other thing was that for the Emiratis, a lot of young Emiratis thought they would be in work after 60, but actually almost 100% of the Emiratis we surveyed above 60, none of them were working. They were retiring. They've all retired. They're very active volunteers. They're very involved in their community associations. But the young Emiratis weren't really aware of that so much. And I think a lot of young people weren't aware of the amount that actually older people give back in their communities and how much support they give it, not just that they're, you know, lying in a bed somewhere playing bridge. So there wasn't always a clear understanding that life after 60 could actually be very, very good, very meaningful, and actually a new time and season to do more for the community.
But then I think back to when I was 20, the thought of being 60 was that it was life is over, rather than it sometimes for many people being a really exciting chapter, and it can be social, it can be sporty, it can be travel and connection and even work to an extent. You know, what do you think would make a big positive difference? If you could wave a magic wand for the over 60s here in the UAE, what do you think would be really beneficial?
Well, I think first of all that we help bring the youth and the older generations together, be they expats or Emiratis, because I think that's the biggest gap here we have now. A lot of dedicated programs to youth, but we're seeing in the West now, you know, we're seeing the phenomena of daycare centers being set up inside old aged homes. Mm-hmm. We see this in, I think, in the US, or some in the UK maybe, Australia.
Yeah, definitely Scandinavia. No doubt they're leading the way.
Yes, I'm sure they're way ahead. So there's these like really being intentional about spaces that bring together both, you know, all generations, so that people can learn from each other, you know, the youth from the older and the older from the youth. And I think, you know, everyone benefits from that. The next thing would be probably the upgrading the aged care infrastructure, like, you know, first of all, doctors, nurses, trained house help. You know, we have a lot of programs training nannies for younger children, but we have no similar programs to train people to work with the elderly. What do they need? How do you lift them? How do you care for them? Those things.
That's really interesting.
And I think Yeah, I think it's really nice. And I think just, you know, just ultimately that really just change that public perception and more visibility of older people and especially older women. I think we see in the UAE more the presence of older men, mm-hmm. but we don't always see older women in the public sphere. And I think we do need to see more of the female side of that as well so that, you know, both sexes can really benefit from, you know, what does it look like, at, you know, plus 60? How is life like that? But really just raising that visibility and that, you know, life does not end at 60.
No, far from it. I mean, the survey found that by 2050, which is not that far away, those age 65 and older will make up 16% of the UAE population. So in some ways, this is a massive opportunity for businesses here to be going, do you know what? This is a group of people that really want to be treated well, may have the finances to spend well. Mm-hmm. And how can we connect them, give them what they want? I mean, I know there's a real movement, certainly in the UK right now, for kind of swanky retirement homes. I actually read about one over the weekend. It's Dubai. You know, it's UAE. Let's put some luxury in there. Help people future-proof themselves.
I think also in attracting retirees, to here, I think there is that, like you said, commercial potential for retirement villages to be set up here to cater for European expatriates who maybe want to spend 6 months of the year in the UAE but don't know where you would go if you're a bit older, you know, what could be catered for. So, yes, I think, yes, I would echo that there is, a massive commercial opportunity that actually even in the next couple of years could be very salient.
Hopefully, I'm going to be on the beach somewhere with playing bridge and levering every minute of it. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Nasser. Really, really, really appreciate it. We
are family. Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Family does matter, and we're talking about the older members of the family this afternoon. Thank you so much for your messages on this. We were speaking earlier to Dr. Natasha Ridge, who says that according to kind of official data, over 60 is elderly, which I refuse to believe. I just did Kilimanjaro with a 63-year-old and he absolutely smashed it. And you guys are getting in touch on similar. Let us know your thoughts. 4001. Gordon saying, I'm 67. I'm not old. Ski, drive Harley, walk 10 kilometres a day and swim, and I can out-party many of the youth of today. And Aruma, thank you, saying, it's a wonderful topic you've raised today. I remember hearing for years and years the country was never developed for elderly expats. You'd rarely find seniors living here on a long-term basis, and delighted it's changed. Such an important part of someone's decision is where they want to live, and it revolves around healthcare facilities catering to my needs at that age. I do like the sound of this London hotel meets Swiss care clinic, although not the £3,000 a week. Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Natasha of the Al-Kasmi Foundation off the back of a recent study saying that we need to ensure that we can care for older people as the population grows over the next few decades. As we said, about 16% of the population is going to be aged 65 and above by 2050. Hannah is a mum of two, and we've spoken to her earlier this year about her mum. Mum has dementia, and her diagnosis obviously has got her thinking about how we care for the elderly. Hannah, thank you so much for being with us today. How is your mum?
Hi, Helen. Thank you for having me back on again. She's certainly no better, but I feel she's probably stable since we last spoke. I got to see her over the summer and introduce her to our new baby, which was lovely. Oh. And she responded really positively to her, but she is struggling in an awful lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Especially after the pandemic. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of confusion,
and it's not surprising. It's an incredibly confusing time, and then you throw in a diagnosis like dementia and also the distance. You know, I think that's something that an awful lot of us have been struggling with. Speaking to my parents over the weekend, and you often just feel so far away and like you can't really get a true picture of what's going on with health, mental health. And I was literally just exchanging some voice notes with a friend of mine last week, and her strange story. Her dad needs a kidney transplant and her mum is going to be the donor. And I was just saying, no, it's like, that's going to mess with your head a bit. But I was just saying, we're at the strange generation, this kind of sandwich generation. We've got kids to care for ourselves, but we've also got our parents to be thinking about as they age. And there's so many different parts to this, you know, obviously the health aspect and the healthcare aspect, what's available to them, what the waiting times are, what specialists are available. But also the social side, you know, feeling connected and part of a community and not losing that identity if you are in a mental space and, you know, in good health to still be out in the world. And what about that social side for your mum? You know, what kind of encounters and conversations is she able to have on a daily or regular basis?
So my mum's a former music teacher, so music is a huge part of keeping her sort of socialised and something which she can enjoy, which doesn't require words or communication. And she used to go to a dementia support group, which was a couple of hours on an afternoon at a local community hall. And there would be a piano in there. She'd play a piano. Sometimes they did little arts and crafts and things like that. But it recently lost its funding and it's closed down. So she doesn't have that anymore. And they sort of sent a note through the door and said, there's another one, but it's about 15 miles away. And, you know, a lot of being able to cope with the conditions such as dementia is having things that are familiar.
That routine, so, those milestones and touch points of familiarity.
Yeah. So that's gone now. And I think that's a key thing when we're talking about what are the vital things that need to be in place in the community to look after our growing aging population, because in the UK, and I know we're talking about the UAE, but in the UK, the number of people aged 85 and over is going to double in the next 20 years.
Wow.
So what is in place? But it feels like at the moment we're losing resources instead of gaining them, which is something we so desperately need. So that's a very kind of general thing, but then when it comes to the healthcare as well, we need doctors who are specialised in dealing with elderly people, which is very hard because the huge range of issues that an elderly person can be suffering with, you know, how can you specialise in something when you can be dealing with anything and everything? And there's such an unpredictability around ageing, but we know we're going to be dealing with it more and more all over the world.
I think we're all in a little bit of denial about that as well, to be honest. You know, overall healthcare is improving, and even, you know, coming off the back of a pandemic, which has been a huge shock to anyone who felt secure in their kind of their health and, you know, their vitality in the world, only to be struck down by COVID. But we know we are living an awful lot longer. We talk about this a lot when we're thinking about, you know, family finances and planning for the future. It's completely inevitable that you don't really want to think about, you know, the what next, the what if. And thank you for highlighting the resource aspect. I know that you, obviously your mum's in the UK, but we hear about this, you know, cutting funding this and percentage that. But when you hear about how that affects one person and their quality of life and their sense of connection and community, and it really does bring it home. It really does. And does she understand why it stopped and how she's feeling about it?
She doesn't understand, and she asks on whatever it was, a Friday morning, why can't we go to that place today? So when someone's suffering with something like dementia, they're not understanding the changes. They don't understand why they suddenly need to wear masks. So that's very difficult. And then that's where the sort of frustration or anger starts coming out on their side, because something so vital to their routine has been taken away without explanation. But I think in general, we just need to get better at talking about getting old. It's an inevitability, whether you're talking about over 60. I would agree with you, that is not old.
It's
in
not
my
old
book. Although saying that, my mum was diagnosed in her late 50s, so, you know, things do sadly start going wrong, but hopefully not that early for everybody. But we're a society in denial. We don't talk about it. It's not, you know, it's not any fun getting older, so we shy away from it. We love talking about babies. We love talking about the start of life. There are a million and one resources and it's fun and lovely, but just as sure as babies are going to be born, people are going to die. People are going to get old. We need to address that and stop pretending it's not going to happen, easier as that is. And I think that's a social problem and something on a very large scale that needs to change, which will then feed down into these resources becoming available, because we're burying our head in the sand.
We are. And you know, as it happens, it could be a huge opportunity. You know, we're going to be an aging population that hasn't necessarily grown up with the internet, but certainly are more tech savvy than ever before. And maybe that's going to be a real shift, a real changing point where people are able to, you know, have technology as part of their day-to-day. But we also need to be thinking about that human connection and how can we have cities and communities and neighbourhoods where people are supported as they get older. And I mean old, not 60.
Yeah.
So there does need to be a massive shift. And I think that actually starts with us. I think it starts with us having some pretty hard conversations with ourselves and with our partners and with our parents, because my dad now is in his mid to late 70s. And if he could do anything to protect me from, you know, emotional or physical pain, he would. He doesn't want to talk about him, you know, struggling with this or feeling that, because he doesn't want to upset his little girl. Listen,
he's certainly young at heart.
Big Dave is young at heart. But, you know, I think when you are expats, you when you don't see your parents for a while, you get a shock. I looked at my dad's 100%. WhatsApp photo yesterday and I was like, God, he was looking really young 10 years ago. Yeah. And when you don't see someone on a daily basis, you think, oh, crikey, I think I hadn't quite realised what, you know, time is marching on.
They like to protect us, and that's another point. You need to have these frank conversations. Mm-hmm. But suddenly these people who've cared for you your whole life, it changes. And even though it's a very slow process, it feels like it happens overnight. Because mm-hmm. suddenly you sort of look at the situation and think, oh my goodness, when did this happen? Mm-hmm. I'm now caring for them and looking ahead and looking what I can put in place to for their care and for their well-being, and suddenly you realize you're the adult.
I know, and it's scary.
It's confronting, and it is scary, and you're kind of looking around for someone to tell you what to do, and there is nobody. And I think especially with getting older, it's a muddling through, because hopefully when you have a baby, you have maternity leave and paternity leave. When you have an elderly parent, you might have compassionate leave after they've passed away. But what happens before then?
The caring, the flexibility that you need. That's you're absolutely right. And I think getting older is a privilege. It really, really is. But there needs to be dignity with that. And I hope that for my parents, and I certainly hope it for myself. But there needs to be some big changes and big conversations to ensure that everyone's having good quality of life up until the end of their days. And thank you for being with us this afternoon, Hannah. All the very best to your mum. Are you going to be able to get back over Christmas, do you think? Or when are you
going
to see her next?
We're going back over Christmas, we are,
Proper family
We're
Christmas.
We're going back, so wish me luck for the babies on the plane.
Listen. All rules go out the window, and it's a finite amount
snacks
of time.
iPad.
Listen, stickers, iPad, snacks, you'll be fine. Hannah, you're a star. Thank you so, so much. Really, really
Thanks,
appreciate
Helen,
your time this afternoon.
Thank you for addressing such an important issue as well.
Thank you.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Last week, we saw Bravo TV announce the launch of The Real Housewives of Dubai. Filming is expected to start next week. It's going to premiere next year. And it marks the first international spin-off of the incredibly popular reality TV show. Loads of rumours and discussions, WhatsApp groups going a bit crazy about who the housewives are going to be and what they can expect as they embark on this new journey into fame through reality TV. Well, speaking to us now is Selena Waterman-Smith. She featured on Series 11 of The Apprentice, the BBC One smash hit series led by billionaire Lord Sugar. She won twice as project manager and was one of the most Googled candidates of all time. She now resides here in Dubai and is on hand to tell us a little bit about what happens behind the scenes on smash TV shows and ultimately what happens to some of the stars when the cameras stop rolling. Selena, how are you this afternoon?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm really well. Thank you for being with us this afternoon. Right, we're going to talk, maybe not names about potential cast, but really like kind of why Dubai could be a good place for a show like this and what some of these cast members need to be aware of. How did you think how do you think it's going to go down? When you heard the announcement about the series, what was your initial reaction?
Oh, it's about time, isn't it, really? I mean, Dubai is the most opulent, over-the-top, glamorous place in the world. And we have some of the wealthiest housewives globally. So I think the show is going to go down extremely well with a local and international audience.
We're all nosy. Isn't that the crux of it? We're all just massive voyeurs. We want to know where people are eating, what they're buying, where they're living. And already lots of people getting in touch saying what they want to see from this series. What do you think it's going to do for people's perception of the city, Selena?
Well, people that don't live in Dubai often have a false perception that, you know, we all drive Ferraris and we bathe in our gold bathtubs and have diamonds on toast every day for breakfast.
No.
So I don't think this program is going to do anything to dispel any of those myths. But who cares, right? It's all entertainment. It's an entertainment show.
I think that's exactly it. We've had a few comments about, you know, it's not showing the real side of Dubai. For some people, this is the real side of Dubai. Sometimes, you know, those extremely extravagant mall trolls and unbelievable cars that, you know, cost, you know, small GDP. Is there reality? It would be interesting to have a real Housewives of Dubai, where you've got people from all different nationalities and income brackets and living in different parts of the city. I'd be very interested to know what's been happening behind the scenes in terms of the casting. Some of the names attached to it are really well known. They've got massive Instagram followings. That wasn't the case for you when you applied for The Apprentice. What, tell us a little bit about that process and how you ended up being on screen, Talina.
So obviously The Apprentice is a very different type of show. Mm-hmm. It is for business people looking to pitch a specific idea and gain investment from Lord Sugar. So probably the casting process differs slightly to The Real Housewives of Dubai. But there's a process of about, I think it's about 8 weeks, and it's a series of meetings, and you get together as groups and you go through all sorts of business related tests and interviews. It's quite an intense process, even going through the audition phase. I think about 40 or 50,000 people apply for The Apprentice wow. every year, so it's quite a feat to even get on it.
It really is, and it catapulted you to fame. As I said, you became the most Googled candidate of that series, and you're now incredibly successful in your own right away from that. But what were you prepared for the level of fame that being on The Apprentice had? Was there anything happening behind the scenes in terms of emotional support or any kind of counselling even for the candidates then?
No, so there really isn't any emotional support. And I know that Love Island has really come under fire mm-hmm. of recent years for not supporting their contestants. But The Apprentice actually is far worse, because it's not really an entertainment show in the same way that Love Island is. It is a show that's designed to break you and test you to your limits. And you're really not prepared for it physically or mentally. And then there's no media training at all for when you come out of the process either, which I think is quite unfair to people. Mm-hmm.
It really is, you know, the impact on your mental health. And I often think about this group of people, because we know there's more and more taking part in reality TV shows, you know, becoming famous through Instagram, about, you know, what happens after the fame. Some people can cope with it. Some people have just been set up for a massive fall. We're going to talk about what you wish you'd known before taking part in reality TV. Let us know what your thoughts are on The Real Housewives of Dubai. Will you be tuning in? Lots of you getting in touch with your thoughts on this. Lisa's saying, I'd love to see a diverse cast with housewives from all backgrounds, including wealth status, career path and culture. But however, knowing how superficial it can be with these shows, we can only assume it'll include a lot of acting versus real life. Do we really want to project a non-diverse cast in all contexts of the world?
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Yes, that's right. The Facebook groups and WhatsApp groups went wild last week as Bravo TV announced the launch of The Real Housewives of Dubai. Are you planning to tune in? Any predictions on the cast? And what would you like to see from this show? Let us know on 4001. You can use the ARN Play app. We're also live on Facebook as well. Joining us to give her take is Selena Waterman-Smith. She featured on Series 11 of the UK's BBC One series, The Apprentice TV show, starring in 9 out of 12 episodes, and was on many a cover of a UK newspaper, catapulted into fame and onto Google as well. So we're getting her take on what these stars can expect from, well, sometimes a bit of the cruel end of the media, Selena. You know, it's not just about being celebrated and getting endorsement deals. There's an awful lot of nastiness out there as well. And I wondered what kind of toll that you've seen fame take on, of course, yourself, but also other people in the public eye.
Oh, I think that especially some of the younger people who are on shows like Love Island, I just don't think they're emotionally equipped to really handle that level of fame. I mean, it's incredibly invasive to suddenly have every tiny aspect of your, what you think is your private life, mm-hmm. splashed over social media and all of the newspapers, and for people to actually be passing judgment on things that are going on in your life that might be quite personal to you.
It's a kind of a deal with the devil, isn't it? You know, there's people wanting to have that fame, and I'm talking specifically about The Real Housewives here. Yours was more of a business endeavour, and wanting to get that platform for your ideas and that buy-in, literally, from billionaire Lord Sugar. But many people getting in touch on this, saying, this should be good, says Misha. I'm just surprised it's taken this long. But why no rumours of Indian cast members? Seems a missing opportunity there. Rex says, I predict this will last one season if they are lucky. Can I ask then, a little bit about what happens after, and what decisions you've made, Selena, about using The Apprentice as a real springboard for the career that you're building now?
Well, look, I broke the mold. I think I actually threw the mold out of the window in terms of what you're supposed to do as an apprentice candidate, because unlike the other reality shows, we're under contract to not talk to the press independently at all.
Wow.
And that's that people don't really know. So we don't have any opportunity as candidates to control our own narrative. And when I saw how they were editing me and how they were portraying me, I immediately thought, well, that's not acceptable to me. And I broke my contract and went out and spoke to the press. So for me, it was kind of better the devil you know. And I thought I'd rather work with the press and try and control my narrative than be a victim and have to stay in silence. Mm-hmm. But all the other apprentice candidates, that's what they do. They don't get any chance to speak up for themselves.
We're talking next about what you have chosen to do, you rebel, you of reality TV, breaking your contract, but here, living here in Dubai. What is next, and what does Selena Waterman-Smith think that these cast members should know as filming starts and premieres next year?
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In conversation now with Dubai-based entrepreneur Selena Waterman-Smith. She featured on Series 11 of the UK's BBC One Apprentice show. And it was a smash hit. She became one of the most Googled candidates of all time. And is speaking to us now a little bit about that news last week. Bravo TV announcing the launch of The Real Housewives of Dubai. Filming is expected to start next week. If you know who's getting involved, message me now on 4001. It's going to premiere next week, and it's the first international spin-off of an incredibly popular reality TV show. So who would you like to see on the cast? Have you got any guesses? And ultimately, will you be tuning in? Let us know. We're getting Selena's take on what happens after the camera rolls and her advice for any cast members as well. Selena, can you explain a little bit about what you do day to day now in Dubai? Because you have been very smart using The Apprentice as a true platform for following your business dreams. But what is that dream, and what's that reality like today?
Well, I've been in business for nearly 20 years, and I've had different businesses. I've been involved in events, storage and shipping, food and beverage. And now I'm concentrating full time on wellness coaching. So I coach individuals, and I work with corporate entities and advise them on their wellness policies. So all of that is fantastically buoyed up by a personal platform in the media.
Can I ask you a little bit about that? Because it's very rare that we hear of someone, apart from, you know, a Love Island contestant getting a £100,000 sponsorship deal with Pretty Little Thing. It tends to be a short-lived career boost and then fading into this weird limbo land of having a face that people recognise, but I can't place you. You're maybe too famous to have a normal job, but not famous enough to make a living from being a ex-reality TV star. And I'm just kind of curious if doing reality TV can be a genuinely good thing for your personal brand and your career long term.
I think ultimately it depends what you make of it. I mean, certainly if you're famous for, you know, wearing a bikini on television, you are going to have a relatively short life unless you can turn that into some of those people end up doing like marriage shows, like Say Yes to the Dress. Then you can spin out your media career into a few
and then
years.
you have a baby on TV, and then you get divorced on TV, and you know, all that stuff.
Exactly. So there is that option. But like you said, for the majority of them, they just don't have that. And they've got a year or two to really make money. And then they're just another old face that we've seen a couple of years ago on a show.
I think that kind of make hay while the sun's shining is a really interesting point, because it's very, very rare that someone has a true career after something like this. And the amount of money that can be made, especially now, and you know, this kind of current climate of being plucked from absolute Instagram to mega, mega fame, you might just have a couple of years of making cash. And it's the same with the NFL. You know, you've got these really young football players who are making hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, but they could well be retired by the time they're 25. So unless you're getting good financial advice and often legal advice, you could be scuppered before you get to your 30s. I think having good people around you must be key. What was that like for you when you came out of The Apprentice? What was your support system like, Selena?
I didn't have a support system per se, but I did have an agent and a PR person that kind of guided me down the correct path. But no, I didn't have a lot of support. I think that would have been nicer to have had some more positivity around me.
That's interesting. And I think there's an awful lot of judgment out there. I'm sure these women that are filming soon will be hyper aware of, you know, what they're going to be perceived like on TV, how, you know, you experience this, how they could be edited out of context perhaps, and I'm not sure, would you do it again? Would you be tempted to get back on the small screen?
Well, with the knowledge I have now, yes, because I know how it all works.
You play the game.
Absolutely. I didn't play the game before. But I think the real difference between my type of show and, you know, The Real Housewives is that I was on what's called a civilian show where you're plucked from obscurity. And these women that are on The Real Housewives of Dubai, or allegedly on it from the articles I've read, they're already independently famous and they're stars in their own right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of them are influencers. Someone was allegedly on that Housewives of London or Women of London or something. So these women, I would imagine, are much better at navigating the media and probably already have quite a thick skin.
Which is absolutely key. I need to pick your brains a little bit about what you're currently doing before I let you go, Selena. We talk a lot on the show about corporate wellness and how some companies take it incredibly seriously. Some people feel like they're just kind of ticking a box so they can put it on their hiring policy. What is Dubai like right now in terms of looking after their employees? Because everyone I speak to is absolutely burnt out and doesn't really know where to turn for a bit of support, and work often isn't the most obvious choice.
Yeah, well, I think wellness is definitely on the, it's definitely become more of a popular trend in Dubai recently. Obviously, with COVID, people are looking at their health in general. And I think now employees are more interested in working with companies that are adding in mental well-being and mental health to their health insurance package. That's something that we've seen on the increase of late.
Please, please, please do this. We have it all the time. Whenever we speak about psychology on the show, so many messages going, why isn't this covered? If you have a broken leg, you know, you go and get an x-ray and you get it treated. But if you are struggling with mental health, you need to finance it on your own, which then compounds the problem more and more. So do you think we're going to see more of that?
Oh, absolutely. And it's a trend that I welcome with open arms, because your mindset is literally everything. Your mental health and well-being facilitates everything else in your life. So if you have an employee that doesn't have a good mental state or is suffering from depression or anxiety, it's in your best interest as an employer to invest in that individual's health, because otherwise it will cost you more in the long term with mental health sort of treatment and absenteeism, and maybe you'll have to replace that employee. So it doesn't just help the employee, it helps the employer as well.
Selena, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. So do you reckon you're going to be tuning in next year when Real Housewives of Dubai is on? Shall we have a screening party?
We should have an actual party. I would love to watch it. I haven't watched the other ones, but because it's Dubai based and Dubai is my home, I'm really excited to see what are they going to do with this, and how entertaining are they going to make it.
How outrageous will it be? Well, watch this space. Selena Waterman, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.